Space Burgers, welcome to the Space Cave. It's David Huntsberger, a big warg to all of you, much needed one for multiple reasons. Hopefully you're, if you don't live in the United States, then perhaps things are going well for you. But if you do, it's a difficult time in American history and kind of tough to go about your normal daily life, or especially if you're trying to, you know, produce or create or offer things into the world that you feel like, well, this is kind of trivial. I mean, there are bigger issues at hand. And I know I normally say, you know, I don't want this show to be a reflection on all the bad things that happen. This should be a nice place to come escape and get away from that. So I don't want to delve into it too much, but, you know, it requires being said to some degree. Like, it is strange to, do you feel, you know, do you just carry on and go, well, it'll sort itself out? Or do you get heavily invested and it'll, I hope you are, I hope you're taking some sort of action or just giving people hugs or just letting people know that you care, doing something to let the general population, just let your friends, your community know that you care about them, that we're all trying to be good to each other. And it's really just these strange outliers and these odd, really sad things that happen that paint such a bleak outlook, and I hope you're dealing with that okay. Yeah, I don't want to dwell on that too much, but it's a rough world out there, and so I want this to be one of the things that you can escape from it, but maybe not be just naive or completely oblivious. I mean, it's worthwhile to care and to be, you know, passionate about, or at least if nothing else, educated about what's happening, and hopefully we can make some sort of difference. It feels a little helpless at this point, beyond just protesting and, you know, I don't know how people can gather or just do a Hands Across America thing and all hug each other. And I don't know, having taken part in that Acme thing where we went to the actual, you know, city council chambers and just watched them ignore our pleas, you know, it can be pretty helpless, even when you do put plans into action and actually, you know, take an initiative. And so something like this, it just feels like, you know, you see cops, or you see people of a different skin color, or you just see the whole community at large, people at large, you just want to walk up and give them a hug and say, hey, we're not so different, you guys. Well, that might seem a little cheesy, but I don't know. The Acme thing was tough, but the week there was good. The you know, the crowds are so great. And I had a few of those interactions that kind of do represent in a weird way how we're all trying to get together. How we're, you know, there was a friend of mine who I did not know was a gun advocate, and passionately so. And we were having a discussion, pretty innocuous at first, just kind of discussing, well, maybe if people are on a terrorist list, or perhaps if they have, you know, mental illness issues, you know, that the checks, the background checks could be a little bit more stringent. And the person I was talking to just went, dude, I care too much about this. You're my friend, and I don't want to feel differently. I got to walk away. He was so passionate about the way gun laws being changed in any way. And I haven't really met anyone like that. You read about people like that, and you assume that they're these strange survivalists that live out in the middle of nowhere who are like, oh, yeah, of course, those people don't have friends. But this is someone that lives in a metropolitan area and is someone I would consider a friend, and still do. I mean, we just see differently on that, and it was just really strange that he did walk away. And then, you know, having another friend there sort of taking, you know, a different stand that in the wake of these recent things has proven to be, in my opinion, idiotic. But those are the discussions we're having with each other and trying to see one another's point. I think I exist in a place of, if if it just means a safe place for everyone, then do whatever you want. But our current sort of laws and regulations, they're not providing a safe environment. And we can keep arguing and say, well, it's this, it's this that's causing it. It's whatever it is, it's all of it. And we need to change most of it. If not ourselves, then definitely some of the regulations and some of the, this is absurd. You have to lock up spray paint because people can't be trusted with it. These high-powered weapons are I don't know. Maybe you're listening and going, hey, that's not the problem. Fair enough, but I think we should be able to talk about it. That's what the most disappointing thing was with my friend, is like, here's someone that I know and trust, and we can't even discuss it. How on earth are people who don't even know each other going to discuss it? And I had a show in Minneapolis. All of them were very fun and very different, like show to show. It was just, I love that place. I hope it gets to stay. If you have the ability to go, sign a petition or show up at City Hall, try to do it. It's worthwhile. I mean, how many things in life do we have like that where we can communicate with each other? I mean, if comedy is just this novelty act and it's not so different than a clown just entertaining you as you wolf down nachos and stuff, then yeah, we don't need it. That can exist in any strip mall. It's just worthless. But we're mostly just avatars yelling at each other in this digital space. There are very few places where human beings show up in a room and communicate with each other face to face, feel that energy, feel like the tone in which, you know, people speak. And granted, it's one person generally with amplified sound. However, by the way your neighbor laughs or their body language, you get a sense of, you know, where you fit in, how everyone's communicating. And I really do feel like comedy has some viability in the world. I think it's necessary. I don't think there are many places where we're able to communicate with each other so effectively. It's just a shame that it's been sort of soured down to this blank kind of, whoa, dating's weird, kind of just banal thing that's not even really an art form in any sort. And so maybe that's why people don't hold it precious anymore. But anyway, there was one show where this lady yelled out in the middle of one of my bits, which was kind of like, I forget what the beginning of it was. It was essentially like not really knowing how you got here. And this lady yelled out, Jesus! And then the bit went on. And then later on, I think she said one more thing. I don't remember. There were like some drunk girls in the front and she was off to the side. So I sort of started talking with her and I was like, you know, I'm a little leery of you. People who yell out Jesus are typically, we don't get along all that great. And then she was upset with me for saying that. She almost got up and left. She goes, I can't take this. Just like my friend with the gun debate, almost left. I said, don't leave. This is one of the few places in the world where you and I, strangers, can communicate with each other. Let's figure this out. I care about you as a person. I don't want to offend you at it, but I also, you can't be yelling out Jesus in the show. And so she did stay, and her husband put his arm around her. And this is a minor detail, but this couple, the husband was black, the wife was white. There's plenty of harmony in the world if you look for it. I mean, that's kind of an asinine aside, but giving you a clearer picture of just kind of the evening at large. And then talking with them, people, this girl in the front, like, raised her hand very politely and goes, that's why you come to a comedy show, to have your beliefs challenged and kind of questioned, and that's what comedy does. And I thought, oh, well, that's why Acme is great, because I don't know that someone would say that at a different club, necessarily. I thought that was pretty unique, and that is, like, no one really feels that way. Most people go to a comedy club to just feel like, we're going to get picked on. Hopefully they'll screw with us a little bit. Maybe we'll send the comedian up a shot. They'll talk about dating and their genitalia, and then we'll get out of here. And if someone was saying, you know, it is where you come to, like, have things challenged or discuss, you know, life at large. I thought that was great. So that was an interesting show, one that I probably won't forget. It just became kind of like we bonded to a certain degree. The crowd was trying to go a few different ways. You know, that lady was getting upset. There were the girls in the front row that were trying to just have a fun kind of bachelorette evening and getting a little drunk. And the rest of the crowd didn't really know where to go, and we just sort of communicated with each other, which human beings don't do all that often, and we are just these avatars screaming at each other. And at the end of the show, the Jesus lady, and I apologize for not knowing her name, but her and her husband were terrific. They turned around completely. She was so ecstatic. She gave me like a mini standing ovation after my set. It was a great feeling. Like, we had started off on opposite ends, and by the end of the show, kind of become buddies. And that does not happen all that frequently. And on the internet, that the same exchange would have ended with just a lot of cursing and exclamation points and you're an idiot. And so maybe there's something there of like we're a society of people being activists in a digital space. And it's great when you see a really impactful tweet go around or something and everyone's liking it and retweeting it. But it does it really have any bearing? You know, I think that maybe that's where we need to... if this technological age is proving to be detrimental to our advancement as a loving society that cares for itself as a community at large, the world, a giant community, instead of these little pockets, maybe that is a place where it's proving to be a little deficient because we're, you know, everyone can be so passionate, but without really having to look at someone else and say, hey, wait a second, I care about you. Tell me what you think and let's solve this. So anyway, that's a lot of neither here nor there. I don't really know how to respond after so many terrible things happen. You hate to start every week of the podcast or every junk show going, all right, guys, terrible news, terrible tragedies. Let's try to get through this. So it's a weird space that we live in, and I hope you're enjoying it. I hope this is a good part of it. Not that this rambliness is not normally the norm for this show. I hope you had a fun 4th of July prior to all this mania ensuing, and I saw bald eagles on the 4th of July. I mean, come on, that was pretty great. It was in Minnesota. People were nice. Everyone's getting along. So hopefully it'll get back to that, and maybe this is one of those things where it finally is a breaking point in, you know, American culture where we finally do push that boulder over the edge a little bit and really get it sorted out. But I mean that probably sounds a little altruistic, and if you're cynical, I can understand it. But wrap yourselves in the extremities of deep space, cloak yourself and being a part of this gigantic universe, and that we're on this one little weird rock that's spinning around, and yeah, there are some bad parts to it, but overall, it's pretty unique just to experience that. And I wanted to play this episode because I think it plays into that. I think it's the kind of, in a weird way, the embodiment of this podcast. And when I say that about a lot of them, they're just these interesting conversations, and there's no beer involved in this one, so if you have your own beer at home, go ahead and open it up, sit back, enjoy whatever you're doing. And this is a conversation with a guy named Aaron Frank, who works at the Kurzweil Singularity University, which is part of like the Google campus at Bethel Field. So my girlfriend and I, my life mate and I, drove there after some shows in San Francisco. And this was a couple years in the making. He had seen me 2 years ago, and I just sort of mentioned when I was working on the One-Headed Beast material, I mentioned the Singularity, and he was like, dude, that's where I work. You should come check it out. And then 2 years went by where, like, I'd be in the Bay Area, and he'd be out of town, or vice versa. Obviously, I wasn't there all that frequently. Anyway, then 2 years later, I'm going back. He says, let's finally do it. So we went and got a private tour. The campus was closed, so it was just us. We drive on. The person at the gate says, oh, go down there to the spaceship, take a right, that's a pretty cool feeling. And we see all this cool kind of NASA stuff and go into this little area. It's just kind of this auditorium. And then off to the side, I think we'll describe it in the episode here, but you'll hear. I apologize if the sound is a little different than usual. I'm just holding my Zoom recorder here and kind of holding it up in my hand. So if you hear any ruffling, that's probably my hand against the recorder. But these are the questions that I think are so fascinating about being a part of this planet and what we're making as humans, why we're making it, what it means. So I hope you enjoy this chat with Aaron Frank from the Singularity University. Enjoy. You would think so. So many people kept coming up to me after shows and being like, San Francisco's not like it used to be, man.
I mean, I've only been there for 2 years. I've lived in the Bay Area for 4 years, and it's not at all what I, like, picture. Like, I picture, like, a bunch of kale-eating, yoga mat, carrying, like, small dog under their arm with, like, tattoos. It's like, I don't know, it's, like, pretty... At least the neighborhood I live in as well, it's kind of homogenous and tech, very tech-minded, and I don't know. I also didn't get the sense that crowd was very tech
I didn't either. What took you there? Because I
the first time.
Yeah, the first time. Yeah.
Free tickets. there was some app that my roommate was like, "Look, there's free tickets at this show tonight." I'm like, "All right, we have nothing else to do. Let's go." Wow. And then your stuff was really. It was like the intersection of philosophy and technology, which is exactly what my roommate and I like spend all of our time talking about.
Oh, interesting.
That,
yeah.
And that's why I reached out to you.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. That's funny that free tickets and that one show.
Yeah.
Because there's a club here, like in Sunnyvale, or you know, closer to here than the Bay Area. So that one show, and I think I just mentioned the Singularity briefly, and like,
yeah, now, I forget what it was, but it was also very, it was very aware that you think about like big kind of like deep questions about the universe, which is kind of interesting because a lot of this stuff that we study here kind of very quickly leads you down the path of asking deep questions about what is consciousness, what is reality when you put on an artificial reality creator machine in your face with virtual reality. It's very quickly you get into these deep questions.
I love it. I mean, I think that's really fortuitous that because that style of thinking and or doing comedy doesn't always elicit a lot of like enthusiasm and or like the show you saw the other night where people, if they don't get on board, it just feels very stale.
Yeah.
But to me, those are the most exciting things about being a human. That's what I want us to be talking about, because where are we going? What is it evolving towards? And people like Kurzweil or Elon Musk are fully on the, we're just in a stage of human evolution.
Yeah.
But it's hard for us to get rid of the, I want physical books, or I want to like, the way people look back so nostalgically about like the 50s. There's a lot of handshaking and like, I provide a service for you. And now it's this untouchable sort of ethereal, like everything's digital.
Yeah.
We're not really interacting as humans so much anymore. And people like them would go, yeah, that's where we're headed. That's the next step. And I feel like, oh, but when someone paints a picture or carves something out of wood or stone, like you feel their human touch on it. It's interesting. Like we're in a very cool part of humanity right now. And I'll miss that if we just turn into like, you know, strictly VR or...
It's really interesting because I think as you see this like exponential launch into the future of just digitally mediated everything, I think there are also areas where you're seeing a return back to things that were like you see it with vinyl, you know, things that. Or I was talking a couple years ago, I was at the Under Armour Innovation Lab. Do you know the apparel company? So they were saying that, you know, they spend all of their R&D and their innovation around information technologies, you know, sensor technologies on their athletes, how to measure physiological performance. But their biggest driver of revenue is hunting gear and like stuff that's been around for thousands of years, like people putting on camo, going out into a swamp and just, you know, trying to shoot a duck with a bow and arrow. That's their fastest growing business.
Which is so strange because like, I guess there are certain things like that that seem to have a terminal. But like people have hunted and successfully killed ducks for hundreds of years with gear. The gear is not making a difference. Ducks are getting wily. We gotta keep outthinking them.
Yeah, it's like arms race. They're learning from us.
We take a step, the ducks take a step. It's just, I think you could still go out. I fish, and I used to like, you know, they gotta wear this sort of clothing. And so for years, like growing up, like wear sort of earth tone shirts and things. And one day I was like, is that true? And I just went out in like a bright white shirt, caught plenty of fish. I think all of that's just like psychosomatic.
Yeah.
Where are you from originally? How did you end up here?
Yeah, so I'm from the East Coast. I moved around a lot when I was a kid. So I was born in Kentucky. I lived in Texas for a while. So my family lives in Philadelphia. That's where I went to high school. So right outside Philadelphia. And then I went to school outside of D.C. at the University of Maryland. So the way I ended up at Singularity University is when I was a senior in university, it was like finals week. My roommate and I were, you know, we're at the library all night and we come home. And we throw on the TV, and it's we're watching the Colbert Report. Was weird about this one show is that he had this crazy futurist on, so it ended up being Ray Kurzweil.
Oh, nice.
So this is the first time I'd ever been exposed to this guy, and something was weird about the interview, because normally Colbert is just ripping into his guests and he just interrupts them and he talks over them.
Yeah.
This is the first time that I'd ever seen Colbert almost just sit back and just let this guy talk. It was just like an open platform. You could tell Colbert was really into this. Mm-hmm. And the thing that blew my mind about this interview was I think always, since I was a little kid, have always been fascinated by this idea, similar to what we were just talking about, that, you know, Elon Musk and others say that we're headed somewhere different. This is like a stage in human evolution. I've always been fascinated by the question as to why, if you look at the story of all of human history, it's looked relatively similar. You know, if you were hungry, you got to pick up a spear and stab something. If you, you know, if you want to find somewhere to sleep, you got to like move the dirt around to like put something down. And today, like, I was born and we have, you know, grocery stores and everything has blinking lights in it and all of these things that we really take for granted. We look around and we're surrounded by, you know, glowing rectangles that connect us to every person on the planet.
Right.
You know, even 100 years ago when you started, you know, the idea of a building, the idea that a bunch of people can get together and like chop wood down and form it into this structure that you can walk inside of with like electrical wiring and keep you, you know, cold when it's hot out and warm when it's cold out, is like all of these things we refer to as technology are so new. They've only existed within the last generation or so. And if you, you know, arguably humans have been around for, you know, 7,000 generations, something weird has happened in the last 150 years or so.
Yeah.
And that always boggled my mind. And so when I saw this Colbert interview, what Kurzweil discussed or described is this idea that that phenomenon is actually a fairly understandable and ultimately predictable phenomenon, which is the idea that the rate of progress is exponential. Mm-hmm. And so it's this idea of exponential growth and the advancement of science and technology that is sort of the underlying mechanism as to why we see the rate of change speed up. And helps to explain why today is seeing so much progress.
One thing with him that I we're gonna see it. If assuming we live anywhere near 2047, is that still the date?
It's like 2045 is the singularity, as Kurzweil sort of describes it.
Okay, because like he always in his projection, and I heard this a long time ago, just getting into science classes, they'd be like, you know, we're growing at this exponential rate. Like it has, hey, they figured out how to make a car and then an airplane, and then pretty soon, like they were strapping weapons to them and using them, and that happens really quickly. Like that's the first airplane, and 20 years later, they're flying it over the ocean. And to think with like the things we have in our hands now, and that it's getting to that exponential, like juicy part of the curve where it's just heading purely vertical.
Yeah.
Will we? I just, in my mind, we'll run out of like, we can only compute so fast at this point. We don't have quantum computing. We don't have the materials for like, when people go, oh, overpopulation, like, we can't just build endlessly. The
right.
whole planet can't become a giant building. So we're going to run out of the materials or the.
So it's really fascinating. So Kurzweil specifically, so there's two things that he makes a distinction between. So one is, so if you look at just computing, you're familiar with Moore's Law. So people, so Moore's Law is this.
The halfway thing?
Yeah, well, so Gordon Moore at Intel about 50 years ago noticed that the rate of which, so basically how many integrated circuits you could fit on a computer chip was doubling every 18 months or so. What that means is that the price performance, actually not the price performance, the computational power of a computer chip was doubling every 18 months or so. And this is why you could go to an Apple store every 18 months, your computer won't be 10% better, it'll be 100% better. It'll be twice as capable.
Sure. Okay.
And so this is why computers, you know, 40 years ago that would have filled a room fit in our pockets. Mm-hmm. And this is a fairly predictable and measurable phenomenon. So Moore's Law is held true for the last 50 years within the time in which we've used integrated circuits as a computing platform. But what's really fascinating, even trippier, is what Kurzweil looked at is he looked back beyond 50 years ago. So he looked at the early 20th century when a computer actually used to be a job for people. There were rooms of what were called calculators. The term calculator comes from a job.
Yeah. And it was mostly women initially, right?
I'm not sure. There's a famous photo that we show of the VA office in the US where they used to calculate veterans benefits, and then also they did missile launch projections, and it is mostly in the picture, it's mostly women. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is the if you plot the price performance, so how much, so if I have $1,000, how much computing power can I buy for $1,000 has held true, has been this steady progression in an exponential way for the last 100 years, like over 100 years. So well before Moore's Law, people, you know, many people are familiar with the concept of Moore's Law, but well before Moore's Law. And so in that time, in those 110 years, we've seen five different paradigms of computing. So we used to have relay, we had vacuum tubes, we had electromechanical computing platforms, and today we use integrated circuits. And so what's really trippy about that is this exponential rule of increase in price performance doesn't really matter, or it hasn't mattered what computing paradigm we've been using. We've seen this steady acceleration in the price performance.
Weird.
It's crazy, which is, I mean, it begs the question, this is why people are so tripped out by this, is it behaves almost like a natural law. It's like if you look out into nature, you know, it's not a natural law. I mean, there's certainly, you know, unnatural reasons why this continues to develop in that way, but it does two things. One, it's a really powerful predictive tool, so you can make a fairly accurate assessment how much computing power will be available in 5 years and 10 years. And then the second piece of that is we as human beings have a really difficult time grasping the concept of exponential growth. Our brains just don't think of exponential growth very easily.
Like person to person here, people just have a difficult time just with time. Like, man, I can't believe I'm older than I once was. I can't believe it's our spring. I can't believe it. Like, and so to look back, and I keep thinking that moment's just ahead of us. In 5 years from now, with, you know, the job infrastructure being entirely different, or the interaction with humans, like when, you know, Facebook and Twitter and all these things, like you assume, like, okay, those are the new platforms that are built, that's it. And then in 5 years or 10 years, you know, when you look back and see like flip phones, and then we're going to look back and see, remember when everyone was staring at their thumbs and those stupid little screens and always looking down?
I just play Snake all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now what's it going to be in just 5 years? Like just 5 years, looking back and going, oh, that was so dumb. Everyone was walking around with those stupid things looking in their hands.
You know, it's great. So we're in a room. So this is the innovation lab for Singularity University. What's crazy, so the other reason exponential growth is interesting, and especially in computing, is what that means is, you know, if you have a computer that's a full building in size, it costs millions of dollars, only the wealthiest research labs have access to it, and only a few select group of highly educated or individuals that have access to, you know, government funding or a large company backing can play with these technologies. Every technology in this room was something that was only available to, you know, a research lab 5, 10, 15 years ago. And so it's like you're saying, things that were once, you know, flip phones, like so this is the
NAO humanoid robot.
Yeah, this is the now robot. So this is a research robotics platform. So basically what this is used for is it's a
the way it I think I'll call it he. It just has kind of a douche vibe.
Yeah, it's got some like guy.
But he's really
tendencies.
Sprawled out. What kind of like the leg spread, reaching forward yoga pose, but he also looks just deflated by life.
It's actually very like bizarre to think about. I mean, this is, it kind of feels like interacting with a dead body in a way. Like it's just not on. It's just not.
Oh, I thought it was maybe like you had to coax it into like doing dancing, moving around. Come on, hop up, buddy.
Yeah, what do you got?
So it's plugged into something.
Yeah.
Oh no, it's not.
No. So I actually. So what's interesting about this, I'll see if I can find the... Okay. Oh, it's got a USB.
The NAO is one of the most advanced autonomous robots for human engagement and has become a standard for advanced HRI exploration. Researchers from the University of Oxford have used it to investigate social and technological aspects of communicating in a public setting, while researchers at Vanderbilt have programmed them for interaction with the autistic. 2007 now replaced Sony's AIBO robot as a standard for the global RoboCup games. Oh, this is a little robot that was playing soccer.
Yeah, they have like teams of these kicking soccer balls.
I love that footage because when they fall over, it's just adorable.
They have to like sort of like work their like wiggle their way back up to like a standing position. Yeah. So I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, 20 years ago, all of the mechanics in the like the joint areas, and this is really why it's so expensive, are these sort of hinges and the way the balance operates, was $20,000 worth of robotic equipment.
Just to make this little thing that stands probably 2 feet tall.
Yeah.
It just looks very dollish.
Yeah. I mean, and today it's a bit more affordable. So it's, I think it's still around between $5,000 and $8,000. Uh-huh. But it's a research, it's designed for research. So you can program it to do interesting things and then test on what it would actually functionally look like embodied in the real world.
Huh. And does it communicate?
Yeah, so these on so on the side of its head, you can kind of see these sort of big, giant speaker ear looking things. So we can it has positional tracking, so it can tell which direction sound is coming from. So it can turn its head to look at you. It can
so
also,
does it because these are on the side? Does it lean in sort of coyishly and point its ear at you, or does it look? Does it is eye contact a thing?
Yeah, so it goes full. It goes eye contact.
Okay.
Yeah, it looks deep into your soul.
And is that something that like, you know, specifically like for autistic kids, like this is a beneficial teaching tool?
I'm not familiar with its application for working with autistic kids, but I could imagine that, you know, having something like this that, I mean, when it's on, it's a little gamey, like it looks kind of gimmicky a bit, but it does embody sort of human-like qualities. It can do it. So the thing that we use it for when we show guests when they come to see it is that we can program it to do tai chi. It can do it can play music and dance to it.
Oh yeah, in the picture here with the kid, it looks like it's kind of, I mean, that's a very dancey kind of move.
Yeah, it looks like it's
even its eyes, like where its head is positioned, is very human-like.
Yeah,
like it's dancing in a very like someone's starting the party.
Yeah, he gets down.
Do his eyes light up when it's on?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. I don't know if that would be cool or creepy.
There definitely are lights on it. I know okay. Up here, I think this outline on the top of the head. So okay. It's got a little bit of the sci-fi. Okay. We're going to have beaming lights coming out of our face.
And element. So how did you... So you saw Kurzweil.
Yeah.
And now you're here at this campus. I saw some of those interviews and I was probably like the general population of like, what? Like, I liked it. He seemed so convincing, but he's an odd-looking guy. Like, he has I don't know how someone would look to say things like that where you'd fully believe them. But the rings and things like that where you're like, is this guy, like, is he just selling us snake oil? Is this just to get attention? Or
yeah. So, I definitely went through kind of a life cycle of my sort of consuming Kurzweil. So Kurzweil's background. So, he spent most of his career at MIT looking at... So the reason he was interested in understanding exponential growth and specifically around computing was he was an inventor. And so the idea was, if I can understand where computing power will be in 5, 10, 15 years, I can start making bets about what types of technologies you can build. And so the reason he looked at this was he invented the flatbed scanner. He invented speech to text for the blind, or the first version of that. He also invented he actually just won a Grammy last year because he invented the first synthesizer.
Wow.
Which sort of launched electronic music.
And they finally just got around to giving him a Grammy
last year. I don't know if you like it.
He went through the whole entire 80s just probably grinding his teeth and like, that's another one.
Or like Avicii concerts, like walking by seeing the billboards, like, that guy, it was his career to me. But yeah, so I think it's interesting. So the first time I ever heard of Kurzweil was the Colbert Report, and then weirdly the same week he was on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah.
So there was an interview where he basically outlines his whole concept of what he calls the singularity, makes it a noun, which this is interesting. I might be somewhat atypical in Singularity University in that I'm not really convinced of this idea of demarcating a specific border between like pre-singularity and post-singularity, because if you look at... So I actually think the term singularity is really interesting. It's basically a term borrowed from physics that is used to describe any environment in which our known understandings of some system no longer make sense. So the event horizon of a black hole is called a singularity. All of the known laws of physics don't apply. And so if you think about what the term means, it basically means anything where we don't really know what's going on. And so Kurzweil says that in 2045, the rate of progress in computing power will essentially create this environment in which machines or artificially intelligent machines are capable or more capable of processing information and thus building the next version of themselves.
Yeah.
Meaning that they then become, and I say they as if they're something other than humans, which is another kind of philosophical question.
Sure.
But these machines will then be the dominant information processing thing. The challenge I think with that is, if you think about trying to predict the future at all, if people come into Singularity University, really the reason they come here is to try and forecast what does the future look like for my business or for my career in the next 5 years or 10 years. Beyond a certain threshold, like I would say even 5 to 10 years, we honestly have no idea what the future looks like.
But his title in a lot of interviews is futurist. So yeah. That's got to be frustrating. People are like, what's my business going to look like? Dude, I don't know. I'm just a futurist. I can give you 2 years.
That's the benefit, though, of using forecasting models like the law of accelerating returns, which is, so Kurzweil's whole academic research was packaged into a concept which is called the law of accelerating returns, which is an essay online. It'll take you maybe 45 minutes to an hour to read. It's amazing. It is really smart. The law of accelerating returns.
Accelerating returns.
And this is really the core. This is the core principle. This law of what he calls is essentially the core principle explaining which systems become subject to exponential growth and why they do that and why. Basically, to summarize it, it's basically saying that the more advanced an environment becomes, the faster it can then advance, because you can use your latest advances to then continue to advance, and so the rate of advancement accelerates.
I have a few. Do you want to walk around a little bit?
Sure.
Okay, so we're in the research department of the Singularity University. That's what this room is called.
Yeah. So this is our innovation lab.
So we're in the
classroom where we do most of our learning programs, and then this room is our innovation lab where we have some of the technologies.
Nice. I'm seeing VR headsets, some drones, the Now robot, this sort of weird platform that the laptop is on.
Oh, I actually haven't seen this.
Kobuki?
But this is a LiDAR system. So I'm actually not familiar with this specifically, but LiDAR is the technologies that self-driving cars use. So the spinning thing on the top of Google cars is called LiDAR. So it's basically laser radar, which basically maps the physical environment around it.
Mm-hmm.
And basically creates a real-time understanding of what it's seeing to then process that data to make sense of, do I turn left? Do I stop? Is there red light? Green light. So this is the technology that it uses.
Before I forget, I'm gonna forget. I feel like in my head I have three questions, but two of them probably kind of go together. So like from a philosophical side, I always like in my stand-up seem to do this, like just as Earth is this sort of like almost like this lab, like we're experimenting, wipe it away, let's start again. And if you were watching humans, you'd be blown away. Like you were just talking about, like you have these atoms that comprise the universe and they organize themselves into it and crawl out of the sea and start just existing. You're like, that's something. Did not see that coming. And then they start organizing the atoms into these things and launching themselves into different realities, different universes, like synthetically.
Yeah.
That scares me. That like this world that we think we know and we know physics could just be a manifest, like it just could be wiped away like that. Like just a delete key and then our consciousness is nothing more than like a simulation.
Yeah.
So what were the dinosaurs? Like why no evolution there? Like if this is just part of our evolution and we went from scavenging being, you know, primitive things to now suddenly like we're extending beyond it and almost in the Kurzweil sense. Is Kurzweil?
I always Kurzweil.
Say Kurzweil. Okay, yeah. I always say Kurzweil. I'll switch that.
It's fine.
Okay.
I'm sure he doesn't mind.
Okay. But in his goal in taking all the vitamins and everything every day to live to that moment, to why would you want to trap your consciousness? Like, how do you line up with that philosophically? Why keep it here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I am also not as convinced on the whole live forever, upload your consciousness into a machine.
Mm-hmm.
Both scientifically, I mean, I understand the idea. So a lot of Kurzweil's and many others, I don't know if you are familiar with cryonics as a technology.
Like, I only know cryogenic freezing. I'm
yeah.
not sure I know cryonics. What is
cryonics
that?
Cryogenic freezing is like the what? Cryonics is the whole science that sort of umbrella term for the idea of preserving. In this case, much of the cryonics community are interested with preserving all of the synaptic connections in your brain. Mm-hmm. The idea being that you can you could basically take all of that pattern of information and then upload that into a computer at some future point in time.
Yeah.
I mean, so your question is really interesting. It's A, why would you want to do that? I mean, I think there's reasons a lot of people are interested in that. And one is, I think, a fear of the unknown, in this case being death. I mean, dying seems like a pretty not sweet thing. You know, living and experiencing stuff seems to be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
You know, why would you want to give that up?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of interesting reasons as to why people would want to continue to do that. I'm not as convinced that so one of the assumptions that Kurzweil and the cryonics community at large take is that consciousness and personality and the who you are is a material thing, that you can materially look inside the brain and everything that is the you, the David Huntsberger,
Emily Rose,
that everything there exists as a physical thing, as a connection in your brain, and that can be stored.
Yeah.
That is a controversial and unproven concept.
And it seems like some of my first stand-up that I ever did was about just kind of like our ability with technology to get to our goals. I mean, our things crash. Our trains still fall off the tracks. Our airplanes still crash. The idea that you're going to map out synapses firing on a level of a trillion per second or whatever it is, and even with quantum computing, and give it a binary sort of code and be like, that's your brain. That's 1 minute of your brain, and we can recycle that over and over throughout your lifetime and just store it somewhere with no mistakes. That seems outrageous. Just one little glitch there could ruin your existence that you're now trapped in infinitely. Terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I think there, scientifically, the technology will allow for that to happen pretty error-free. I imagine, you know, if you look at aviation, we actually have solved the idea of you know, getting these big metal tubes to fly through the sky pretty well figured out.
But I mean, you know, when people are afraid of flying and you go, the mistake rate is like 0.0001%. But that's also not your consciousness, not your life. I mean, that's a pretty high error rate, I think.
Yeah.
If they're trying to match exactly you, and you know, that's, maybe we're already dealing with that with people that do have really, you know, brain abnormalities or, you know, really terrible sort of mental conditions. It's just,
there's
hard to get that right.
There's also something, so I was talking to one of our, so every summer we run a 10-week a summer program where we bring in 80 students from around the world to study. They basically spend 7 weeks learning about all of these technologies, and then the last 3 weeks they form teams to create a company or a project around how would you solve a big problem. We could talk about that later, but one of our students from last summer, she's a researcher at the University of Amsterdam. She's a PhD candidate, and she always when we, because she's one of these, I think, somewhat skeptical on the uploading your mind to a machine. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she always points out is that we tend to forget that a lot of consciousness actually is part of a physical, like what's called embodied consciousness. The fact that you have a body is a major component. There's no intelligent, I shouldn't say that. There's nothing that has a brain that exists in the world that doesn't also have a body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's so much unknowns around how much of our intelligence is actually stored in a physical thing. The other thing, if you think about, is, you know, the idea of uploading your brain into a machine, Kurzweil very explicitly makes the point that your personality is stored in would be stored in that computer at that point. But if you think about, it's a fairly new understanding that we're coming to with things like the microbiome, the idea that, you know, the trillions of bacteria that live in and inside of your body and on you do things like regulate your blood chemistry. They they help regulate your hormones, which all play into your personality.
Because you hear about people having like a fecal transplant and developing new metabolism, different, like, oh, I wake up earlier, or I suddenly like this type of food, or I, you know, it really can change their overall person.
Yeah, which is fascinating. I mean, this is influenced by things that aren't really even you. It's things that live on you, right?
Yeah.
Like you as a person are more of an ecosystem than a thing, this, you know, fleshy, you know, squishy pile of brain in your head that, you know, makes you who you are. It's just very uncertain in terms of, you know, will you be able to preserve who you are in a machine? I'm not as convinced by that.
Do you know, did I do the joke the other night about Francis Crick and like the sending little capsules out into space?
No.
Okay. So like, I have this working theory I'm getting deep into that is some sort of bacteria was a pest in some other galaxy or universe, and they were sort of extradited or quarantined on Earth in an ocean. Like, you're never getting out of there. And then it just figured out, like, and I think it's a similar thing to like the selfish gene, where it figured out how to combine into, you know, little amoebas, and then they combined into more, and let's become fish and let's develop eyes, and like with all kind of a goal in mind, like, let's really get ourselves back to where we came from and exact revenge on them. So like, these little bacterias are in us, ruling us from our gut, and of course they want us to be safe. Cars that don't crash, planes that don't crash, big buildings that we don't leave, you know, stay in your chair, be in VR, keep us safe. You house us, and we have revenge on our mind. And so the safest way, I think, that they could still potentially live, although if we become machines, that's bad for them, no bacteria anymore. But I think if they are somehow still incorporated into it and we're in a mechanical body, that's pretty nice. Like, they're safe then. And then that's the whole goal of whatever we are, is we're just a part of that as they go wherever they came from and get their revenge finally.
These
quite the thing.
Yeah, nasty little bacteria.
Yeah.
Jerks.
Yeah, they're just, it's complete assholes that got...
They are driven.
Yeah, they're driven. And it's going well for them so far. I mean, we are getting to that place.
I actually don't think that's that far-fetched of a way of framing it. I mean, if you think about it, we really are... It's kind of a reductionist thing to say, but we are basically vesicles for carrying both bacteria, which in a way you could centralize all of biology, or at least human biology, around us just being these carrying things, like these cars that bacteria, they used to live in the swamp and now they live on these like fleshy monkey things that walk around. And that's not that far-fetched to centralize, you know, understanding biology around these bacteria. The other thing that we carry around are our ideas. I mean, if you think about a lot of what's, you know, people also ask the question, so if progress has accelerated or scientific advancement has accelerated, why are we the lucky generation that get to live with iPhones and blinking lights and airplanes and space shuttles? And what's interesting is throughout all of human history, there's really been one thing which has sort of increase the rate of progress, which is how connected people are, because how connected people are means more ideas can be exchanged more freely. So like 10,000 years ago, we first started living in cities. You didn't have to, you know, get on a horse and ride 3 days away if you had an idea for something. You could just tell the guy walking down the street next to you, and as a result, you get agriculture and writing and mathematics and calculus and all of these things. And today, again, we take for granted how new it is, but the internet is 26 years old. It's new. It's only been around in its growing, you know, version of itself for the last 15 years.
And when it happens, you know, almost kind of weekly, the different way that ads present themselves to you, the way in the beginning it was like frames, and then people were using Flash and taking forever to load up. You're like, I don't care about this stupid leaves blowing to unveil your website. Just let me in there. And so no one really has like an enter button anymore on their website, because it's just exhausting in an obviously not exhausting way, but like,
it's so tired.
I can't sit here and watch this. Just let me enter. And now everything, like, we went through this phase 90s where everyone was trying to be more dynamic, more exciting, and now it's just like, just give me the information. Like, just give me a flat, basic HTML page. And where's that going to go? Is it going to stay that way? I always wanted to do a page where you, like, went through a galaxy and you went planet to planet to, like, go to the store site and go to the comments or whatever, and you'd, like, fly through space. But that takes so much energy and effort and bandwidth that it doesn't make sense.
Have you tried any of the virtual reality headsets?
She has this one for her phone. It's an app. It's kind of, it's very basic. But
You have it for the cardboard?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So have you tried the Gear or the Oculus or
No.
So I don't know if these are probably not on, so I don't know if we can demo it today, but I really recommend, because it's one of those things that it's hard to describe to like, oh, it's cool. You basically stare at a screen and you like turn your head and it like renders what you're seeing, but it's actually, I mean, it recreates the sensation of actually being where you think you are. So like you just said, you could be in a web page. I feel like this is where the internet is going. You'll physically feel like you're navigating to different galaxies and going
that's the future.
Around. Yeah.
I mean, imagine, and because like when you push, like you're swimming through in VR, it feels like there's like a viscous quality to like the air or anything, the way you move. And if you could just paddle yourself and now you're flying along through it, that's amazing.
Yeah,
it's so fun.
There's actually, I wanted to ask you, because I saw one of your bits online where you do the simulation, where this is a simulation and we create the simulation, they crawl out of the water and then they Hydron Collider, and then I don't want to take the bit. I forget the bit, but it's
something about like we're just watching them replicate it. They crawl out and they keep doing the same thing.
Yeah.
They put on shoes and look around. We should make a particle collider.
Yeah.
And make another. It just keeps going down and down.
Yeah. I'm curious. Are you familiar with the transcension hypothesis at all? I feel like you would love this. So,
what was the other one? Can you write this down?
The Ray Kurzweil thing.
No. The law
of accelerating returns.
Accelerating returns.
Yeah. I can send you. I'll send you the essay. I'll email you the essay, but this one, the transcendent hypothesis, this for me is one of the things that I think actually I'll describe it, but I think it just so well describes what we're seeing happen in the world and what we started talking about, where we're going. So there's a futurist, his name is John Smart, who theorized an answer to the question, do you know Fermi's paradox?
Ooh, I've heard of that. Is that Ferme?
It's Fermi. So Enrico Fermi was a physicist.
Okay.
So Fermi's paradox is just a name given to the question as to why, when we look out into the universe seems to be really well designed to support life.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the last 10 years and even more recently in the last few years, we keep just expanding the number of habitable planets that rotate around a star system that could support life. We've seen here on Earth that as soon as water formed, as soon as the environment supported water, like life instantly appeared.
Yeah.
And there's evidence that comets and these things are like glazed with organic compounds that just fly around the universe, like little like life biology seeds, just planting the organic compounds for life. It looks like we live in this like life spawning factory of a place, and we're finding billions and billions of planets that could support life. The problem is we have no evidence of it. We look out into the sky, there's nothing there. There's like SETI that's out looking for radio signals. There's just absolutely no evidence that there's any other intelligent life.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the paradox. So Fermi's paradox is named after this physicist who pointed out, well, we live in this, you know, really well-suited place for life, but there's no evidence of it. What's going on? So that's the paradox. There are tons and tons of theories, hypotheses as to why that happened. Do you know the blog Wait But Why?
No.
Okay, that's another amazing blog. It's this like cartoonist, this guy Tim Urban, who just creates these long form articles and creates cartoons to like explain complex topics.
Oh, I like it.
Really cool. Elon Musk, this is a total sidebar, but Elon Musk read this guy's blog and basically said, this guy's awesome, invited him to SpaceX and gave him like a tour. Elon Musk never gives interviews, spent like 10 hours with this guy and let him write like a full sort of in-depth explanation of what he's doing. But anyway, so this guy, Wait But Why, did a great article post about Fermi's paradox and all of the different theories as to why there are no aliens. Mm-hmm. So then this guy, John Smart, he's a futurist. He comes up with what's called the transcendent hypothesis.
Okay.
Basically says that as any sufficiently advanced society or technology creating species, so humans on planet Earth are, you know, a technology creating species, as they get sufficiently advanced, they don't colonize outer space, which is what happens at a young stage of development, mm-hmm. which is what we're seeing. You know, we're sending, you know, satellites and probes, and we're, you know, talking about going to Mars. But what happens is we don't colonize outer space. What actually happens is we go inward, we colonize inner space. And so computers that used to be full buildings now fit in our pockets, will eventually be the size of blood cells, and then ultimately may, you know, you may have almost like black hole like environments where you have computational environments so densely packed that are so small that you could house entire realities in these like infinitely small environments. And so,
and
we
then
actually,
the people in there in those environments would look around and go, it's so big,
yeah,
it's so huge,
exactly,
well, there's nothing out there.
And the reason when we look out into space is we don't see evidence of advanced life forms is they don't colonize outward, they actually, as they become sufficiently advanced, they basically poof out of existence into these virtual environments.
I like that, that makes sense.
Wow.
To me.
Which is, if you look around, it's like kind of like what's happening. I mean, things that were once physical things like flashlights, you know, there used to be like factories and supply chains and trucks delivering boxes of flashlights to Walmart where you'd go and you'd like take it home and plug mm-hmm. a battery in it. Now it's just lines of code on your phone. It's mm-hmm. just an app.
Yeah.
It's literally just technology. It's become a virtual thing. GPS systems, you know, have been like vaporized out of existence from your dashboard into this, you know, phone on your, or onto this app on your phone. And
I like this.
Yeah, I mean, this,
so where do we come in, where do we fit into this? We're in a bed somewhere wearing a VR helmet, you know, are we going into it? Where do we fit in? We're the overlords, the gods watching this.
So my favorite example that maybe I, so to be honest, I have no idea if, first
give
of
me
all,
the answers.
I want to know. Yeah, I mean, first of all, this is just a theory, right? It's just a hypothesis. I think it's a really helpful one to help make sense of what's happening in the world. There's a video game coming out in, I think it just got pushed, the launch date. It was supposed to come out in the summer. I think it's still coming out in August. It's called No Man's Sky.
Okay. Was this a Kickstarter one?
No, this is a big production. This is like a sort of an epic kind of like the Deadpool like launch of video games, like lines around the corner of the game store.
Wow.
So the way this game was developed is so fascinating. So they basically created, I forget the name, I'm blanking on the name of the method that they use. It's procedurally generated. So they used an AI to procedurally generate, I don't know if I'm saying that right, the game map. So basically, instead of having programmers explicitly design the game, they gave these AI algorithms essentially a sort of a scaffolding of how to go about making the game, and then the AIs go around programming the game map. And so you as a game player have the opportunity to travel around 18 quintillion planets inside this game world. So if you wanted to play this entire game, uh-huh. it would take you 5 billion years to navigate the entire game map. So if you think about that, we are literally creating an artificial universe. It's got its own laws of physics. It's got, you know, it's got its let there be light moment where you, you know, turn it on and press play, mm-hmm. where you as the gamer basically become this explorer traveling around this artificial universe that you could literally spend 5 billion years and never explore the entire reality.
I believe this was Julian McCullough. I apologize if I'm attributing the wrong Twitter credit, but essentially tweeted like, have you ever played a video game level so hard that you thought, screw this, I'll go deal with my own real problems? Which I feel like a game like that brings that up a lot, which is, I want an escape that is solvable and kind of simple. I don't want to suddenly be perplexed and frustrated and grasping the complexities of an endless universe and infinite amounts of options. Just looking at like, that would be, I would imagine it'd be very like, you could get so stagnant because you look out at it and go,
Oh boy, 18 billion options. I want to just have five levels and then see a princess saved and be done with it.
Give me Tetris. I'll snap some blocks together.
Oh, because the things you would think, and that's life in general, like the things you would think about that you're missing. And that's what makes me maybe kind of understand wanting to trap your consciousness forever. It's like, I was a Formula One racer, and then I finished that, and then I was someone who climbed Mount Everest, and then I did that. And then I was someone who went and lived with chimps, and I did that. But we're all locked into currently, like, well, I've devoted my life to, like, being at the Singularity University and exploring that. I've traveled around with a little recorder and
it's fuzzy. I like it. It's got a little, like, fuzzy head.
Yeah, that keeps the wind from... See, I can move it like this, and in theory, since I don't have headphones right now, it's not making much wind noise, but I can't...
Can't confirm that.
But this little bit of technology fits in pretty nicely here.
Part two next week as we move to a different location in the lab. I hope you enjoyed that. I think Aaron's a fascinating guy. I think the university itself, the lab we were in, is really unique. I'll try to remember to post some pictures because, you know, the little robots and drones and things we were seeing, it's not that intimidating. I think you expect to see, like they do in the movies or something, you know, like this clandestine Area 51. And maybe that does exist there, but overall, it gave me a better picture of what they're doing there, which is just look at the world, see what we're inventing, what it means to us, and what implications it could potentially have. And so it feels good to know that, you know, our future is in the hands, at least to some degree, of people like that, who aren't just blindly making stuff and going, all right, give me money, I made it, on to the next thing. Like, they kind of care about the implications. And we'll pick up that talk next week and get more into, even more into the philosophical side of things. Anyway, hopefully better things ahead in the coming week. I hope you're doing great. Your week goes well. Thanks for being a part of this show. It's nice chatting with you guys. It's nice to interact a bit, and the emails and guest suggestions and beer suggestions and running into people on the road and seeing some space burgers is great. I met four at once, a bushel of space burgers in Minneapolis. That was cool. And, happy to give people stickers and things like that. And thanks for being a part of the show. And if you're commenting or rating or whatever all that stuff is on iTunes, I appreciate it. If you're in LA, come to the Junk Show. It's the second Sunday of every month. This was recorded before the most recent one happened, but hopefully it was fun. You never know after a tumultuous week, but sometimes, you know, people want to come out and get their mind off of that. And hopefully this was able to do that a bit for you. Yeah, better things ahead. Here's some music from Peter Matthew Bauer. Hope I'm saying that correctly. This is another Mexican Summer artist. Thanks again to them. Terrific label. All the music they've sent, I've listened to repeatedly. I love it. This is off an album called Liberation, and this is called Scientologist Airplane Conversations. I hope you like it. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave. No direction, no.